This podcast is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries. Unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability, criminal prosecution, and the wrath of the tall man.
Boy!
Hey, let's talk about you. The ID10T community events at ID10T.com, like Russ Stevens, a.k.a. Cool Movies Darth, who has started a podcast called 90 for Chill, which Russ says is dedicated to movies with a runtime between 74 and 99 minutes, the time frame that I feel is ideal. Russ, I could not agree with you more. That is a fantastic idea. Russ goes on to say, there are times you need a cinematic fix but don't have time for the latest Scorsese masterpiece or offering from a comic book universe. There's also times when you know you need a conclusion to prevent a binge costing you a whole night. My guests and I try to follow these guidelines as we chat up features that are definitely worth your time and are beyond easy to make time for. 90 for Chill, the podcast, can be found on all major podcast platforms at 94chill.com, and that's spelling out 90, N-I-N-E-T-Y, 4-F-O-R, chill. So there you go. Thank you so much for sharing, Russ. Really great idea for a podcast. Events at ID10T.com for everyone else.
Little Hand says it's time to rock and roll.
Bring the noise.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
Raise a call.
I'm calling about what happened in New York.
Ghostbusters Afterlife. Exclusively in theaters.
So the iPhone is out and my notes for my viewing last night are prepared. So I found Ghostbusters Afterlife to be quite a bit of fun for a Ghostbusters fan, especially one of the original. It's interesting because this film obviously relying on children for the most part as your cast. The story is centered around the Spangler grandchildren whose mother and them have recently just been evicted, but Egon Spangler, Harold Ramis' character from the original, had recently passed away, so hence they should inherit his property, which is in the town of Sunnyvale, Oklahoma, which has been suffering from continuous earthquakes since about 2016, so about a 5-year period. As I say, the film focuses on children, so that kind of hurts it if you're going to try comparing it as a comedy to the original Ghostbusters, since you can't really count on kids to improvise. But perhaps Jason Reitman, who said in the special features that on the DVD that I rented from Redbox, immediately popped up after the film had concluded, said this is just basically a dream he had about making his own Ghostbusters movie about a kid who finds a proton pack. So it's an interesting way to embrace the universe. So it gives us a new take. It kind of places it on a different level while still maintaining being a Ghostbusters feature. This is why Ghostbusters 2016 or Answer the Call just doesn't really work as a Ghostbusters movie. It's a fun little comedy. A little bit long, and I think a big problem with that is you have great sketch actresses in Kirsten Rigg, Kate McKinnon, Leslie Jones, but are they really the comedic geniuses that were Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Harold Ramis? So as they say, with franchises, you can afford to have a little extra time to establish the universe. These kids are obviously not Ghostbusters, nor are they paranormal scientists to begin with, so it's going to take them time to figure things out. I would say that justifies the first hour of the feature. Well, maybe 45 minutes. I don't know if we necessarily needed to bring up a love interest for the 15-year-old elder brother of the two. It does give us the father of the love interest being Bokeem Woodbine, which is cool, despite I don't think this is really, I can see this if this was Tulsa, Oklahoma working, just after Watchmen, but I don't know. It just seems like the ethnic diversity in a flyover state is a little too diverse. I mean, come on, Stranger Things just left us with a token minority in that TV show, and it works fine. Maybe I'm just not traveling further enough west to see how things have changed, but I digress. Better than Ghostbusters 2, I'd say, because we have people walking into this universe opposed to just like, and here's a continuation with another story of them busting Ghost, which I will say kind of ends up being a detriment a little bit, because we are just running over the Gozer story again. And I think they could have done a few things differently. Let's, you know, evolve this Keymaster gatekeeper thing, but it does give us Paul Rudd running away from little demonic Stave Puffed Marshmallow Mans, which are quite charming in all honesty, and ends up being a great callback at the end, which this does right, I guess, is that the callbacks are all nailed, all to perfection, which is something you don't get in 2016's cluster muck. I do kind of wish they did give us a little bit of a mention of Ghostbusters 2. I wish we kind of had a more original villain instead of just Gozer. Trying to recall what we all enjoyed. Like, it's funny, at work, there's only one steelbook copy of Ghostbusters 2 in the entire store. I don't know if it's still there. I didn't check today. Because it's $16.99. I'm waiting it to get below $9.99 before I pick it up. So I'm not, I understand Ghostbusters 2 is not really anything worth remembering, but I mean, if we could have got the little Peter McNichol character, Giannis, I think it was, you know, pawning over a ghost, that doesn't sound too bad. And I guess that's kind of something that's missing, is the perverse little elements. I mean, the worst you get is an ode to Rick Moranis and Sigourney Weaver in the first film, and otherwise, you know, just a third base joke, really. And it's kind of like, it's just, you know, you kind of think some things are just a little too obvious. For the most part, since it's not containing the primary cast for the majority of it from the original feature, spoiler alert, but I think they gave that away in the commercials for the DVD release, you kind of enjoy just subtle little jokes instead of just smart alecky improv that you get from our not ready for primetime players, as they were once called. So as I say, I would have mixed some elements from Ghostbusters 2 into it to make this an ideal homage to the original franchise. I mean, come on, Jason Reitman. Ghostbusters 2, I think, was your acting premiere. If you did that, we might lose the Marshmallow Man, and I guess that was a safe choice. As I say, it nails all the callbacks great, especially the Marshmallow Man callback at the end. And you got characters I can relate to, like the character named Podcast. Kind of also plays into how nerds can be all over, especially once they start interacting with the original Ghostbusters, which is not even, I doubt it's even 5 minutes of the feature. And, you know, some may complain that, hey, we got ourselves a CG Harold Ramis, but dude, it's a touching enough homage. I mean, tribute. I kind of had a tear ready. You know, if you could do that, you're at least as good as the worst Star Wars movie. So, and I bought the worst Star Wars movie, and I've watched it many a time. So I think if you're a fan of the original Ghostbusters film, this isn't going to disappoint you. I think it's a nice throwback, and it kind of leaves itself open. Because I think with movies, once you get into the sequel realm, your sequel's got to be ready to open up for new sequels. So I don't know how you do another movie. I don't know if this is worth Jason Reitman giving up all his prestige cred with films like Juno, Up in the Air, Thank You for Smoking, Young Adult. He did this for himself, I think, and it's kind of cool that you can trust him with this material. And I think that makes him a great director who's probably going to be bastardized by the Marvel system. But that's a conversation for another day. Hey, I got 2 days off. Maybe I'll run into the Poetic Critic and we'll address that. So thanks for coming in to listen to me rant about the Ghostbusters movie not bastardizing my childhood. Which, I don't want to be that harsh, but yeah, 2016 may have done that. It's just a silly movie. And oh, that's something I do love about this one. Hardly any slime, if any slime. I think they realized that people got fed up with it in 2016. 2016, as they say, is a fun movie on its own, but it just doesn't have the same kind of charm because it's not the same kind of format, and it didn't take a new approach to it. All they did was just try to put different sketch players in. So Jason Reitman, I think, nailed it with this feature. It's at least a 3.5-star movie, maybe a 4. With that said, I'll probably turn back to movies like Ready or Not more often. But I am, going to wait for this to get on sale sometime, or if I see a steelbook, which I didn't even see a slot for it in my retailer, I might grab that. Otherwise, it's definitely, I think this one, unlike Ghostbusters 2, is at least worth $10. So that is my verdict. So thanks again for coming to 90 for Chilled, the podcast. Thank you, Stacia Harden, for keeping me in check and keeping me rolling and inspired. And I hope you do that for everyone else who you touched in your life. We'll be back next week with Gregory Carl to talk about Jodie Foster versus a perverted Martin Sheen in 1976, The Girl Who Lived Down the Lane. Until then, just rate, subscribe on your podcast apps. And if you want to talk trash to me, the Twitter handle is @CatBusRuss. Distract me, because I kind of got myself into a war with some conservative see you next Tuesdays. So thanks again for coming to the 90 for Chilled podcast. Hope you have a great week, and can't wait to try to impress you next week.
Can I hear a wahoo?
I got a few seconds left before that 15-minute window on YouTube. I kind of caught myself thinking, oh great, I'm sounding like my mom about casting minorities in historical plays and films and such, when I was talking about diversity issues in the middle of Oklahoma. I'm just going to say, like, it was hard enough to find any black people in New York in 1984. It just kind of seems like an overcompensation. And with that said, at $5,000 a ghost capture, did anybody in Harlem in 1984 get their haunts taken care of by the Ghostbusters? Is the Ghostbusters inherently racist? Just something to think about.
Previously on 94 Chill, the podcast.
These children are going to the most glamorous of all summer camps, Camp Mohawk. There's a 2-year waiting list, and every child has to be voted in. On top of all that, it costs $1,000 a week to go to Camp Mohawk. The question is it worth $1,000 a week?
It sure is. It's the best darn camp there is.
Well, are you connected with Camp Mohawk?
Well, I think so. I'm the program director, Jerry Aldean.
Well, how do you justify $1,000 a week?
Well, we have some special programs. We're doing Shakespeare in the Round again this year, of course. Our political roundtable, Henry Kissinger, will appear. Yasser Arafat is going to come out, spend a weekend with the kids, just rap with them.
That's amazing.
And the kids wanted animals, so this year each camper will stalk and kill his own bear at our private wildlife preserve.
Are you sure the children can hack that?
We'll see. But the real excitement, of course, is going to come at the end of the summer, during Sexual Awareness Week. We import 200 hookers from around the world, and each camper, armed with only a thermos of coffee and $2,000 cash, tries to visit as many countries as he can. And the winner, of course, is named King of Sexual Awareness Week and is allowed to rape and pillage neighboring towns until camp ends.
That's incredible.
What do you expect for $1,000 a week? Hey, you have a good summer too, huh?
Yeah, it still screws with me whenever I hear that now. So, welcome to 90 for Chill, the podcast. And this week we're kind of doing a backdoor way of talking about a 1984 comedy classic, which I don't think anything really compares to it still, which was directed by Ivan Reitman, written by Harold Ramis, starring Bill Murray, and throw in Dan Aykroyd and some other Second City folks. And you have a podcast that's probably would have been better timed if we were waiting for Ghostbusters Afterlife. But so, and this week, it's a newer format for me because I may have run into you in passing, but My guest is Andrew, and I don't want to screw up that pronunciation of last name.
Everyone does. It's pronounced TD. It's spelled not TD, but it's German, so of course it's goofy.
Oh, yeah. Now you're talking to somebody whose last name is Stevens, who gets so upset when I see it spelled with a PH. And you got to blame the Krauts for that one.
Oh, yeah.
So, just to get right into it then, well, I guess, you know, a little about yourself. I kind of found you through a little bit of mutual friends, all with a comedy background or some extent.
Yeah, I've been doing stand-up off and on for about 5 years, currently in an off period because I need to do some writing. Mm. But yeah, stand-up in the Central Illinois, Champaign area. Just like being funny.
Well, that's, well, you, if you don't want to be funny, then I don't know what's the point of living, in all honesty. Can't take anything too seriously. So, my closest connection to the Champagne scene is the Tuttle Brothers, which I got to know back when they were the Phoenix Twins on the independent wrestling circuit.
You have known them for a hot minute. Yeah. I only learned about the Phoenix Twins after knowing them for a little bit and through some YouTube videos. But yeah, I've known them for about 6 or 7 years now. Great guys. Love working with them. Run the best open mic around. Awesome guys.
Oh, no. I've seen them open a lot of acts up at the Jukebox Comedy Club, originally from Peoria. So,
gotcha.
Yeah, good bunch of guys. I mean, uber talented. I mean, they could have. They were going pretty hard there, wrestling wise, and you know, you could usually get on the big stage, twin gimmick for a year or two. So,
oh yeah,
but I guess we'll just go right into you know, how we're going to get to the final destination here, which kind of like, I guess that'd be the next step in horror comedy, is trying to get from Saturday Night Live to Final Destination. I guess David Koechner is the closest thing we have to that.
But yeah.
So we have Saturday Night Live in 1975, you know, it started in 74, and, you know, by 79, 78, really, we start getting movies starring these guys, and you got two names in common, at least from the creative standpoint, I think, or I guess from the artist standpoint. You got John Landis, and you have Ivan Reitman. Ivan Reitman was a producer of, up until Animal House, I would say he was probably best known for his Cronenberg films, yeah. Shivers and Rabid. Shivers is a easy classic. Rabid, kind of like the remake a little more, but I mean, there's some better scenes in the original Rabid, but you know, any chance you get to see a mall Santa just randomly mowed down.
That's definitely a highlight. Almost up there with the garbage day line from Silent Night 2, I believe.
Oh. Haven't gotten around to the Silent Night, Deadly Night series. They're kind of hard to track down. They've always been hard to track down. And, you know, living in the Midwest, we know the reasons why and such.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, well, it gets us to, Ivan Reitman, producer, John Landis, the director, and then you'd go to 1979, you get to see Ivan Reitman's first effort with Bill Murray, Meatballs, which is a
cult classic.
Yeah, it's a classic. And I guess after doing some research for this, I can't really say Ivan Reitman was ever really a great director. I think
he had the embarrassment of riches of directing great actors.
Yes, but I mean, once we tried running it back in 2001, I think it was, with Evolution.
Yeah, that was kind of the peek behind the curtain of realizing, oh, so it was Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and all these other great actors that made his movies, you know, the memorable classics that they are. Not knocking Evolution that much because it was entertaining, but it doesn't hold up to his previous works.
No. And I can't really say I've seen too much. I mean, since I'm focusing on, you know, sub 100 minute movies, I can't really say I've seen, you know, had to go and watch too many of his other features. I mean, he's got Twins, he's got Kindergarten Cop. I guess he was just your go-to. This guy is not going to screw it up.
Right. If you want a comedy with a little bit of heart in it, he was your guy back in the 80s and 90s.
So, but when you look at his classics, Harold Ramis is not too far removed. I know Reitman wasn't involved with Caddyshack, but I mean, that really, I think,
in the same vein of a Reitman movie, with Harold Ramis directing it, and
they worked together on Animal House, so
yeah.
So, and I mean, I rewatched Caddyshack, and it is more about its scenes than it is about narrative. Plenty of stories about how they really just had to keep shooting extra stuff for it. It was so thin.
Well, there's classic stories from some of the Caddy actors talking about how, you know, at first they were the central focus of the movie, written by Don Kenny and Bill Murray's brother, Patrick Doyle Murray.
Yeah.
But when you have Chevy Chase and you have Rodney Dangerfield and you have Bill Murray in their heyday, obviously the focus of the movie is going to shift to those characters.
Yes. I think that's where I have prefer Meatballs, just because I can't really say it has a, you know, solid protagonist in it, but you kind of just head back to Rudy, and Rudy is dependent on Bill Murray to work.
Right. And they try to do that with the Danny O'Keefe character and Chevy Chase a little bit.
Yes.
It doesn't quite flow as good as, like you were saying, the Rudy and Bill Murray dynamic in Meatballs.
Well, I don't know. I rewatch it, and like Rodney Dangerfield, this is like, I think it was really his first movie.
It was his first thing out of stand up and late night appearances.
Right. So I think he kind of takes away, like, if you had somebody different who wasn't so dependent on, you know, your classic.
I don't know. I kind of like the Rodney Dangerfield stick. You know, some of my favorite lines in that movie are like, "Hey, take the stick back. I can see the marks where the jockey was hitting it." You know, "Oh, look at this hat. Oh, it looks good on you, sir."
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm saying from a narrative standpoint, if we would have gone with trying to think of somebody to fill in that role, and it's kind of difficult when you have Ted Baxter as a guy who's definitely not what he was on Mary Tyler Moore.
Right.
So,
but then you bring up an interesting question, like, who from that time could you even see doing that role? Like, I have a hard time fathoming anyone I could see other than Rodney Dangerfield in that role.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess my immediate, like, maybe somebody from, Second City, the Canadian version. John Candy, maybe. Martin Short.
Yeah, I automatically go to John Candy when you say that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say, well, the easy answer is Belushi, but
right,
that's the ultimate crutch.
Right, I mean, it is as good of a comedic actor and. Really, if you see some of his dramatic stuff, also he could do real acting. It just is kind of seemed like the automatic go-to comedy crutch to just throw Belushi into any
yes
classic comedy.
Right. I mean, the only real mark on him would be Neighbors, and I haven't taken the time to rediscover that one.
I watched that about 10 years ago, and I could see why it gets panned, but I didn't think it was that bad for what it was.
Well, I mean, that's the only time Aykroyd's really gotten to play the non-straight guy. I mean, unless, you know, you got Nothing But Trouble.
I was about to say Nothing But Trouble, which I really didn't think I was going to think about that movie today because I tried not to think about that movie.
Okay, my older sister was a huge movie nut, and Asperger's on top of that. So I got to hear all the reviews since she wasn't really a social person. So I got to hear it all secondhand. So I saved myself from dodged a lot of bullets, I think.
What drives me nuts about that movie is you had Chevy Chase, who, yes, his star was starting to wane a little bit at that point, but he still had a lot of comedy clout. You had Dan Aykroyd, you had John Candy.
Yeah.
You had Demi Moore. And hell, you even had a guest appearance by Digital Underground. And I'm still trying to figure out how that movie became that.
Well, I mean, 1989, I mean, it's kind of... Aykroyd was kind of dependent on the sequel, I think, to Ghostbusters, and I think he was just screwing around otherwise. Because isn't it Aykroyd as the director on that one? Or
I know he was a writer. I can't remember if he directed that one or not. Again, sorry, I didn't prepare for that because, like I said,
I mean, it's
only prepare for a Nothing But Trouble. That's just not something I'm.
we're just going, you know. All I've got to my movie credentials is a couple of professors at ICC. I should just say instructors. I don't want to. I did run into those instructors who wanted to flaunt their doctorate at Illinois Central College.
But the one place you should flaunt a doctorate would be Illinois Central
College. Yes, good old I Can Count, ICC. Harvard on the Hill. I mean, all I did was write a great paper comparing and contrasting Juice to Angels with 30 Faces, and just impressed the mass comm teacher enough with all the film analyzing. So I admit I'm not my strong suit. Went back to college, went back there to try being a screenwriter. And of course, by the time I get that class, it was so tedious, I dropped it. So
there you go. Yeah. And I should say that my film credentials just comes from the fact that I just watched a epic butt ton of movies in my life. I was in the Army and deployed to Iraq twice. And all you really have to do is just watch the same DVDs over and over. So yeah, I am well versed as a official couch potato movie junkie. Those are my movie credentials.
I have a book,
How to Write Screenwriting for Dummies, but that's as close as I've ever gone into educating myself in the film world.
Well, I mean, ironic, coincidentally, and I'm not going to do that Alanis Morissette bullshit. my first wrestling gimmick was based around the Complete Idiot's Guide to Professional Wrestling. That was my prop, and wrestling for me was difficult just because I was a, you know, tough man fighter and a high school wrestler, you know, trying to be a legit badass, and then I find that as my gimmick, and they just lean into the chicken shit portion of it and get a little frustrated about that.
Yeah.
But all the blame for the lack of career is on me, though. But I do have my wrestling gear bag in the trunk. I don't consider myself retired. I'm like 7-Eleven. I might not be working, but I'm always open. So
nice.
Yeah.
And nice Boondock Saints reference.
Yes. I do my best to recognize the first one. I mean, I saw the second one in theaters, and
so you were the one.
Yeah. Actually, another guest on the podcast, Joe Goldwitzer, did too.
But okay.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, we know why Troy Duffy is not around.
Yeah, talk about a meltdown.
Oh. Well, I don't know if he just thought that since he was able to sell it, that he thought he was Tarantino right away, or...
I mean, the dude makes arguably one of the biggest cult classics of the 1990s.
Yeah.
Fantastic movie. I even have the McManus brother prayer tattooed on my rib cage. That's how much of a movie that impact that movie made on me.
I've got it memorized. That's all I can. Had the poster up for a while.
I committed the ink. But yeah, but he makes this movie when it should have never been a success, but it was, and his head almost imploded with how fast it expanded.
Well, he was a pain to deal with, though, to begin with. I mean, it could have been bigger if he wouldn't have screwed around with the Weinsteins. I mean, they're the first people that got it.
Right. And yeah. To be fair, I mean, you know, knowing what we know about the Weinsteins, the Weinsteins now, you probably could take them for a few extra bucks. But yeah, back then, with, you know, go the Kevin Smith route if you're dealing with the Weinsteins. Be humble, be gracious, and then we'll work towards bigger projects next time.
Right. Yeah, you just, I mean, I don't know. Cubs fan, Tuffy Rhodes, debut, 3 home runs.
And, right.
You know, so, but, all right. So now that's what I like about podcasting, those, the tangents. Especially when we're not really experts or can claim to be.
No.
So, but you know, Nothing But Trouble gave us Boondock Saints. I think, we shined that turd up pretty well.
We did polish that turd quite nicely. I think we've given, Nothing But Trouble the most publicity it's had in 20 years.
Yeah, that is definitely there. And, seeing my podcast numbers, it gets weird when you go to my source Podbean, but like, yeah, I know it's doing better than that, but it's still, you know, 300 people. Okay. They had to go through that trip with us. So, Aykroyd. So that was about Aykroyd and not being, you know, his inability to be to branch out from the straight man situation. And, but again, it's kind of a parallel path though. Cause as I say, John Landis is the other driving force behind getting these, Saturday Night Live guys to the top, with the Blues Brothers, obviously Belushi, right. Landis, worked with Ramis and Reitman, of course, with Animal House. And I, you know, these guys are a pain in the ass for the concept of 90 for Chill, just because they're so funny. It's very difficult to want to cut anything they offer.
Right. I
mean, Blues Brothers is Illinois' greatest movie. There's no question about that.
It's just a giant love letter to Illinois.
Yeah, but it's still really 2 hours. Like, I mean,
and back then they weren't making 2 hour comedies. They were barely making 90 minute comedies.
Right. Then. Yeah. So, I can't think of anything I would cut. You know, the only thing I could say that you could cut would be musical numbers, but that
is part of the charm of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as you said musical number, the first thing I thought of was Aretha Franklin singing in a diner.
Right? Yes. It's, and, you know, for being a Illinois guy who, you know, spent a good portion, you know, my 20s going to Chicago every weekend, wrestling related for the most part, you know, getting to learn that area. I'm enchanted, you know, when I decided to get that change of scenery from Peoria, It was like, what areas do I know how to get around? And it was Champaign-Urbana and Chicagoland. But, you know, I'm afraid the money I'll be making.
You made the better decision. I love Chicago, but I will not drive there. My ex-wife and I, she had family in Chicago. And
okay.
I said, as often as you want, but you're doing the driving. The traffic is horrible. The train situation weirds me out. I grew up in a town of 1,000 people, so Chicago to me is just insane.
Yeah. Oh, no, no, most people, I mean, I know plenty of people from my hometown of Morton, which is 15,000. I know a lot of people come right back. You know, some of them are, you know, big fish in a little pond people, but a lot of them just can't adjust to it. For me, choosing Champaign was like, well, the money I'll be making, this is probably the safer area.
Right.
And every apartment complex has, I've had to deal with the cops some point. And
check local listings, but if you see the local Champaign news, there's always a very down story, we'll put it that way. It seems like about once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And the word shots fired are heard way too often.
Yes. Kind of glad that I just cut off Comcast cable TV and my dad hooked me up with a VPN. So I don't really have to worry about hearing about that, except when I go to work and somebody who's got the police tracker on at the bank. So, Chicago's definitely a great place to visit. There's no question about that. I think we can all agree upon that.
Well, yeah, they got Cubs games and pizza.
I don't know. I'm more in the that's a casserole, but not a casserole. It's a.
I've heard it called a casserole. I've heard it called a bread bowl.
Yeah.
I call it pizza because I'm not picky. It's tasty. I'll eat it. Bring it on.
Well, I guess my thing is that it took a long time before you could get Chicago style pizza, say at Wrigley Field. You know. Sure. Not really practical when you can just get your crappy little Connie's or.
Well, I don't know. They got some really quality nachos there now. It's one of the big things they're pumping these days.
Yeah, no, I usually stop by and get a bison dog whenever I'm up there, but. Definitely not the Wrigleyville I used to love, though.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, ever since they put the scoreboards up, it kind of like.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of the diehards, you know, poo-poo that.
But, I mean, and I guess it's just, you know, a lot of the old stores I would go and visit after the games, they're not there anymore. Getting a little too high class for me.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But I mean that is the it's probably the greatest joke in Illinois cinema is they don't have my they don't have my address.
Yes.
So we're going from I guess the only stop in between here and the destination would be Stripes, which is kind of the, I guess you kind of say the dress rehearsal for Ghostbusters in a sense.
Yeah, because again, you had Harold Ramis doing a lot of the writing on that one.
Reitman directing.
I believe it was the first time the three of those guys got together.
Yeah.
Project that all on the same page, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, and of course, again with comedy legends like John Candy and whatnot in it.
John Larquette's all right.
Yeah, very. I actually enjoy that character. I think as a smarmy straight man, he did a great job in that role. It's definitely, like I said, I was in the Army. It's definitely a movie that we quote a lot.
Okay.
I'm a bigger, huskier guy, so like when John Candy's like, you know, I figure, you know, I join the army and lose a few pounds, and you know, that resonated with me.
Yeah. Again, that one does feel long. I don't think there's any way to too many movies, I think, in that one.
Yeah, because they spend you know, a good chunk of time on the training portion, and then they spend an equal amount of time on them out of basic training.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. It was almost like a tale of two movies.
Right. I mean, you wanted an action movie.
Right. It was two good movies, but it was also two, I don't want to say butting of heads, like I said, with the second half of the movie. But yeah, like I said, it's still one of my favorite movies, but it definitely does kind of have a slight, I don't want to use the word identity crisis midway through, but it definitely does shift tones.
Yeah, there's the biggest thing, I mean, Stripes, and this is the thing, I think, with the comedies of the early 80s involving the Saturday Night Live actors. Parents just didn't give a damn if their kids saw it.
Well, you got to remember, PG-13 didn't even exist at that point. PG-13 came out until about 3 or 4 years later with Gremlins and Indiana Jones.
Right, but what I'm getting at is Stripes is a definite R.
Oh, yeah.
Caddyshack, I was kind of like, okay, did we really need to... Well, it's 12:30 and I'm watching this, so maybe we needed the boobs there, but it's...
As a perpetual immature teenager, I think we always need the boobs, but...
You see, I've had...
But I agree, they don't add to the comedy.
Right. I've written blogs also, too, and I can say they're so brisk in... such brisk breast in...
Yeah, in Caddyshack, they're almost blinking and missing boobs.
Yeah. But it's kind of a... I had a thought, but... It's just kind of like... You know, these... When you look at... When you go to Stripes, and it's like...
The mud wrestling scene.
Mud wrestling. Well, John Larroquette doing the...
Perving in the showers.
Yeah. It's like...
You could work with the mud wrestling scene.
Right.
The shower scene is a little gratuitous.
Yeah.
I mean, again, granted, you know, 10-year-old me watching that when my parents weren't home thought it was the greatest thing ever. But
right. Right. No, I guess my thing would be I've written about it. It's like, I am all about gratuitous nudity. Just sex scenes seems like, I just can't come up with three, four pages to fill this script up. Right. So, I mean, there are
scenes in comedy movies where, you know, the nudity helps with the joke. 40-Year-Old Virgin did a really good job at that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, like I said, sometimes you're having boobs for the sake of boobs. And, you know, like I said, I appreciate nudity in films as long as it's warranted. Like I said, I don't think you could do a Porky's without nudity.
No.
Did it get a little far with the nudity in Porky's? Absolutely. But again, I don't think you can do Porky's without some form of nudity.
Right. Yeah. I'm just saying, I don't really care. Yeah. If you're going to do an R, give us everything. But yeah. I'm just saying sex scenes. That's where I was kind of like, most of those don't actually add anything, unless you do a montage during it, like Rapid Fire with Brandon Lee,
or Deadpool comes to mind.
Yes, yes. Oh, that is right. I mean, it's easy. You can obviously say Monster Ball. That aggressive thing is something. Yeah, but as I say, boobs can be put anywhere. I mean, it's kind of like the classic guy with his dick out during Teen Wolf. You know,
which
I'm
still trying to figure out. He had to have paid an editor because there's no way that should have gotten that far into the process.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm just saying it's kind of like, if it's there, it's there,
right?
But as I say though, when I'm 41, so Well, Lord knows I wouldn't be able to pay it. Who knows? I may have actually seen Stripes at 1 year old. You know, my mom said if it wasn't for HBO, she wouldn't know how she'd survive the pregnancies. But I don't know. I was raised as the second oldest child, but the child who seemed the most normal. I got, like, I couldn't see R-rated movies till I was 17. And
I can remember watching Barbarella with my old man when I was probably 7 years old. And for those of you who have not seen the classic sci-fi movie Barbarella, the first 5 minutes of the opening credits is a woman floating around undressing and naked in space.
Yes, yes. You gotta admire the Fondas. I mean, they have such a legacy, but they're not afraid to do that weird stuff. But I don't know. I would think that Barbarella still got this is where we get into that weird realm of PG without a PG-13.
Right.
Because I think it's still a PG, and then you even have the orgasm scene.
Back then, R required like blood and guts. Like sex didn't fall. Like you weren't going to get a G, obviously, with a Barbarella, but you would get a very strong PG.
Right. Like my dad back in Peoria, every Thanksgiving, one of the local radio stations, like after at noon, every Thanksgiving would play the entire Alice's Restaurant song.
We have a station here in Champaign that does the same thing.
Oh, now I'm glad. I've been down here 5 years and I'm still learning stuff. So he eventually put the movie, got the VHS tape, put the movie on, and then I'm like thrown off by, whoa. Does mom know about this?
That's like you said, that's definitely one of those, okay, mom's not home, let's watch this movie.
Yeah. But thinking back now, the late 60s, like it just reminds me of how I have to get myself a copy of Putney Swope, if you've ever seen that one. It's
right.
Robert Downey Sr. my dad's favorite movie, but he didn't say that was his favorite movie until we were all, you know, 20, you know, pretty much all us kids were 21. What he would say, and it was more of the political decision, political call, his favorite movie, and I think we've gotten to the here. I don't think of anything between in 82 or 83 with our guys.
Not off the top of my head.
No. Ghostbusters.
Yes.
So, as I say, I will, you know, to get people on the podcast, I think it's the lawyer my parents say I should have been. I will try to weasel my way into anything. And honestly, I looked at the time and on this one, it's an hour 46.
Yeah, it's a hair over the 90-minute requirement. I don't think, like I said, I don't think this movie goes on too long.
No. It's honestly got more stuff. Like, it doesn't feel like it goes on too long, but the beauty of it is, yeah, it doesn't feel like it, but there is a lot of stuff, a lot of acts. I mean, it's
and people don't realize that Ghostbusters lives and dies by the fact that it's very exposition-y, if that's a word. You know, like there's a lot of exposition in that movie because you have to explain all these ghosts and, you know, supernatural lore in addition to, you know, a screwball Bill Murray comedy.
Yeah. And I would love to see, well, I mean, obviously I was at a Wizard World convention up in Chicago, and they had a panel with Ivan Reitman and Ernie Hudson.
Okay.
So basically an Ivan Reitman one.
Sure.
So, I mean, I wanted to go and drop questions on Ernie about the best four, but I mean, he had The Crow. I kind of feel bad. I tried searching. I just did it on Siri on my Apple TV. Ernie Hudson. No results.
So, oh, wow.
So it's like, what, Sony's got to deal with Apple, and this is like the old VHS where everything is pan and scan, and oh, Ernie Hudson's cut out.
That's wild, man.
Yeah.
The movies he's been in, that's wild.
I know. I mean, you got The Crow.
Substitute.
Yeah. Oh, that now it's like, I got to start looking down the times of those, of the Substitute franchise. I mean, they're all bad movies, but
horrible movies, but horrible in the best way possible.
Yes. I mean, especially the Treat Williams stuff where he's beating kids off the yo-yo to like,
I totally forgot about the yo-yo.
Yeah. You know, seeing a guy get thrown through a, well, you didn't get to see him, but it was a brilliant cut. But
oh, yeah.
Evil Mark Anthony, I mean.
Yeah, like the one time I actually like would look at Mark Anthony and actually like take him seriously, because you see him singing and you just, yeah, he doesn't have the same gravitas.
No. Makes you wonder if J-Lo wasn't a fly girl and if she just did the Rosie Perez stuff instead, how things would be different.
I honestly think that Mark Anthony was the lucky one in that thing. Like, I don't know if he was packing or what, but like how he landed J-Lo, I'll never know.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's, I can understand. Yeah, I mean, I can understand A-Rod ending up with J-Lo. I mean,
sure, good looking dude, rich as hell.
Right. Affleck's a little on the screwy side.
He was the, I mean, now I can't speak for why they're together now, but you know, back in the, you know, 20 years ago, he was the actor du jour, so that kind of made sense.
Well, actor du jour is in chicken noodle soup is your du jour. I mean, because
I didn't say it was, you know, etouffee. I
just, no. I'm just saying reindeer's games, man.
Oh yeah, I forgot. I blocked that one from my memory.
Well, I mean, boobs keep that in my mind, unfortunately.
That's true. Yeah, that is the only reason I probably watched that movie to begin with. Because,
but but there's Atomic Blonde, and Charlize Theron is a very brave actress. So
yeah, she ain't afraid of shit.
Yeah. So we're so let's see. Ivan Reitman talking about Ghostbusters. Oh, okay. Ghostbusters, I mean, it was the first thing of its kind. I mean, it was originally supposed to be a space movie.
Right, because in the original Dan Aykroyd script before Harold Ramis was brought on to help him rewrite, yeah, it was set in the future. There, you know, Sigourney Weaver's character was an alien. They were more like supernatural janitors than they were paranormal eliminators.
Like, I guess that all ends up being Space Truckers, by directed by Stuart Gordon with Dennis Hopper and pre-Blade Stephen Dorff.
was that pre or post Blade?
I think it was pre 96, okay. 98 okay, Blade.
That was pre. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth a watch just for Charles Dance trying to get it up with his.
The image of the square pig will never.
Oh,
God, that, yeah, it's burned in my brain.
Yeah, I wasn't. My dad worked at Cat, so I didn't really have to worry about the ever seeing the farmer side of Illinois.
I grew up on a farm, so I mean that stuff never bothered me. Just the image of a physically square.
Right. Yeah, no, that's what I'm getting at. It's not the. It's not seeing a pig in a crate. It's seeing a
right
maximizing. I mean, I'm just wondering if anybody from Tyson saw that and like, this is what we got to work towards.
I could see that. I could definitely see them trying to make cube shaped chickens.
Well, I mean, Minecraft.
Oh yeah. That might have been the inspiration.
Right. So. Yeah, it's supposed to be a space movie, and then regardless, they had to build pretty much their special effects from scratch.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
again, early 80s, special effects, the way we think of them now, are still in their infancy, still doing a lot of matte painting stuff and, rotoscoping and stuff like that, as opposed to pure CG.
Right. But, I mean, even at that point, the only thing you had was LucasArts. Not Lucas.
Industrial Light and Magic.
ILM. Right. So if you didn't get him on, if you didn't want to spend the money to get him on board, Lucas on board,
people that he had fired and any Jim Henson people you could find.
Yes. And again, they're all the leftover guys. It's Ghostbusters just ends up being this anomaly, I guess. I mean, because nobody's ever really been able to nail these elements. Closest thing I'd say is Galaxy Quest.
I can see that. They're definitely in the same vein. Yeah, it's definitely one of those things like when we're trying to be romantic comedy, we're trying to be physical comedy, buddy comedy, slapstick comedy. Oh, yeah, we're also trying to be a light horror movie, all in the same movie.
Right, and not insult your audience as well.
Right. I mean, like I said, with a runtime of only an hour and 40 some minutes, that's a lot to cram into something like
that. Right. And, and it's just how they had to do everything. It was basically like, they had there was a lot more to Dan Aykroyd getting blown by a ghost than just the blown by a ghost scene.
Which is still something that I know some of my friends still fantasize about to this day.
Well, I mean, it made it into Ex Machina, so.
But, I mean, even going to the opening scene of, Bill Murray doing the experiment with the goopy-haired guy and the attractive blonde,
yeah.
you knew that this was going to be something different. Like, Sigourney Weaver says it best, because she actually ad-libbed the line, "You're more like a game show host," because originally it was supposed to be more like a car salesman. But, yeah, Bill Murray, as a scientist, is something that I never knew I wanted until I saw it. And he definitely brings just enough smarminess and smartassery and, heart to that character to make it work. And you can tell right off the bat at the beginning of the movie that this, buckle in, we're going to have fun with this movie.
Ghostbusters 2, kind of a,
it was good.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first one, but it was still good. I mean, it kept the ingredients and it kept the formula that made the first one good. But tried to experiment a little bit, but I still like that movie.
Oh no, it's a retread, and it's like, not until I buy my 4K Blu-ray version of Ghostbusters did I really realize. Yeah, I mean, it's not half the movie of Ghostbusters, but it is Ghostbusters. Like,
I mean, okay, for the big scene at the end, we're going to trade out a 50-foot marshmallow man with the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of rinse, wash, repeat. I do like the fact that, they had Bill Murray starting from the ground zero level with the Sigourney Weaver character.
Yeah.
Trying to rebuild that. So, I mean.
Oh, perfect place to rebuild him as his television host thing. I mean, it's a full circle thing.
Exactly. Again, going back to the game show host line from the first one, now he's a smarmy talk show host dealing with, semi-credible psychics.
Yes. And I don't know. I'm a Kurt Fuller guy. I can appreciate him.
You can't go wrong with Kurt Fuller. I remember the first movie I ever saw him in was No Holds Barred with Hulk Hogan.
Yes. Oh, no. I don't know. Well, no, it was weird. 89 was a weird year because I guess it was probably Warner Brothers told Family Channel, start rerunning the original Batman series.
Oh, yes.
And that's 88. And my mom wants us to take us all to Batman, and she's never done anything against the rules. My little brother is 3 years old at this point. I'm 9. My older sister's 12. and like, oh no, we're gonna see Batman. All right, that's cool. And then you say, all right, Hulk Hogan, you know how much of a wrestling fan I am. Like, you got me to go through this pre-diabetic shots and shit as a 3-4-year-old by bribing me with Hogan toys. Yeah, I got to see this. And it's like, nope, PG-13. Like, now the rule applies.
But yeah, we'll go see Batman, which was a movie that should not have been, I mean, should not have been allowed for children.
Oh, no.
I remember, because I was probably eight or so years old when I saw that, and it scared the shit out of me.
Well, you know, that was the beauty of Batman Returns. It course corrected my mom on that one.
Oh, yeah. It was more campy. It was more cartoonish. It was more in line with the target audience, you know, because, you know, parents back in 1989 when that movie came out, like, oh, yeah, because Batman's on Saturday morning cartoons, you know, yeah. The Justice League and Super Friends and whatnot. They kind of forgot about the Frank Miller comic books that these movies were loosely based on.
Yes. I think more Alan Moore. Of course, Kevin Smith pointed out this on a Dinner for Five. Going back to Tim Burton and the Ape Lincoln joke at the end of the 2001 remake.
Yes.
Of Planet of the Apes. And I guess Smith had already done it in his comic books.
Yes, he done it in his Chasing Dogma comic, I believe.
Yes, exactly. No, and I guess his publisher said, "Hey, do you want to put this on page 6 that
yes.
Tim Burton stole from you?"
Oh yes, and they were laughing and jovial, and then the tee hee hees don't translate the print very well.
Yeah, but then
pissed.
Tim Burton's pissed. He responds, "I don't know what he's talking about. I don't read comic books." And then Kevin Smith's final retort was, "Well, that explains Batman."
Exactly.
But 89, you had Ghostbusters 2. And then, you know, dads are just so much cooler than moms if you have them around, I guess. Because, I mean, it's a changing world. My dad found UHF. He actually went and watched it himself before he let us watch it. But
oh, wow,
he was very adamant on letting us watch it after he watched it. So again, a PG-13, and really all you can say is about that is the Gandhi 2 and the Conan the Librarian were a little intense.
Now, see, here's the difference between your father and my father. My father saw UHF, and we were banned from watching it in my house.
Oh. You see,
because my father has a low tolerance for stupidity, and he didn't think there was anything funny about it. He just thought it was stupid. And of course, at this point, I'm about 8 years old. I already have 3 Weird Al Yankovic albums,
yeah,
of stories that I'm listening to religiously. And the fact that I couldn't watch that movie for many years, I didn't watch that movie till like probably in my 20s.
Yeah, it's still as good as it was back when I was a kid. I'll say that about it. But going on about 1989, I guess it was like Batman just kind of, Batman was, you know, 88. Well, I think 87, 86, maybe even 85, there weren't $100 million grossing movies.
No, there was good action movies in that time frame, but as far as like the big blockbuster,
yeah, nothing made over $100 million until Who Framed Roger Rabbit,
which I was talking about how my father didn't appreciate UHF. He didn't care for that one either, but at least that one was allowed to be watched in the house because he figured it was a kid's movie because it had cartoons in it. Never mind all the sexual innuendos. And
oh no,
the rabbit exists.
I have my VHS copy from, I have not taken the time to frame by frame it, but
I have, and it's not, oh, it's cracked up.
Yeah, but, you know, we're the generation that bought Girls Gone Wild DVDs. I mean, those are definitely not.
If I had a nickel for every time I woke up from a bender in the late 90s and heard one of those commercials on Comedy Central at 1:30 in the morning, I could have retired years ago.
Well, as they said in basketball, you know, if I had a nickel for every time Lazy Boy got me out of a jam, I'd have a shit ton of nickels.
Exactly, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, Ghostbusters is, I mean, this is the movie that, you know, I think everybody kind of just thought Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and company, you know, Chevy Chase, Steve Martin, were all just going to be something you could laugh off and a flash in a pan.
Sure. And no one expected the legacy this movie would leave behind. I mean, it spawned multiple animated series, toy lines, sequels, yeah. You know, say what you will about the reboot, and we're not going to go there.
Well, let's just say Sony puts that out with a free when you start your Vudu subscription, or at least that's how I have a copy of it. I haven't watched it. It just seemed like an ill-advised idea. Like, I can understand maybe having two female Ghostbusters, but Bikini Kill meets Ghostbusters.
I've seen the movie, and I want to preface this by saying I love every actress in that movie. I think they're all funny. I was excited to see the movie. I thought it was an interesting concept. They're just bound by, the legacy of the other one, obviously, is, you know, a big boot to fill. You don't want to be in those shoes, but also poorly timed jokes and gags and, you know, a lot of gross out humor and just, you know, if you're gonna try to play with the original, try, you know, going with the source material as opposed to, hey, let's see how many times we can throw slime on this girl's chest.
Mm. Yeah, was it a straight up reboot or?
It was a straight up reboot. It had nothing to do with the originals. Yeah, they did cameos from everybody. Like, at the end of the movie, there's a cut scene where they're listening to some ghost radio and they're like, hey, what's Zool? You know, referencing the villain from the original movie, kind of setting that up for the proposed sequel, which never happened. So, yeah. I mean, they were playing off the original with some, you know, lines and gags, but it was its own movie.
Okay.
Because, in fact, Aykroyd, Murray, and Ernie Reyes, they're all in the movie, but they play different characters, and there's even a statue of Harold Ramis to pay homage to him. But yeah,
I don't know. That's a movie that's just spawns so many reactions, I guess, is its issue.
Well, like, Sony also hadn't had a big movie in a while, so it was also, you know, they'd just signed over Spider-Man, you know, to Marvel, so they weren't getting all the money off that deal. So it was basically a cash grab.
Right. No, go with what you know. No, don't. I've had that argument with my older sister on this podcast before about.
You can always get money on nostalgia.
Right. But yeah, Ghostbusters is just there's just certain things you can't remake, really. Like, nobody's going to try Citizen Kane again.
Right, exactly. You're not going to see a Citizen Kane. You're not going to see, you know, Gone with the Wind remake.
Well, there's good reason that there's not going to be Gone with the Wind
remake. Besides the obvious reasons on that.
Yeah, but... I had a thought. You can't go and remake or reboot, try to recapture if you're not doing what you're. I don't know. Well, I was basically gonna say last 2 weeks ago on this podcast, I suggested Michael Pena as Scarface, but
I would only want to see that if he's playing the character he played in Ant-Man.
Well, no, that's the inspiration for saying like Scarface is Michael Pena's Scarface. But I mean, even with Scarface, though, that was weak, you know, limitedly derived from the original film.
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't know. When it comes to remakes, it's like, why aren't we doing bad movies that we love?
Right.
Like Hudson Hawk.
Again, not to harp too much on the Ghostbusters reboot. Like I said, I think the cast was a great cast. Like it wasn't their fault. Like I said, I think it was crappy writing and weird effects and stuff like that. Like I said, I never want to bag on anyone that was in that movie. Because again, I am a fan of a lot of their other projects.
Right. Well, I think Chris Hemsworth has done enough bad stuff.
I don't know. I actually like the thought of having Chris Hemsworth play a complete bimbo in that movie.
Oh, no. I think that's one of the draws to that movie, in all honesty. Like, because you got to move past, like, we're really going to restart this with girls. And then, well, they are giving us Chris Hemsworth being dorky. I don't know. It makes me further appreciate, let's see, which is the oldest brother who's on Westworlds. I think that's Luke Hemsworth.
Yeah. Not Liam, the other one.
No, I think it's Luke.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's never made it big. I mean, the only thing I've seen him in besides Westworld is a Australian movie that Simon Pegg had a supporting character in it called Kill Me Three Times.
I've heard of that one, and I know he's also done a couple direct-to-DVD westerns.
Huh. I mean, Kill Me Three Times. It's fun. I'd have to rewatch it. I'm sure I ripped it onto my CD to my DVD. I got a Windows 10 computer usually hooked up with old DVD software that hasn't been picked up yet by the studios in terms of copyright protection.
Sure.
But they have not been, just to let the public know, they have not been released publicly. So they have not been redistributed. I am not paying $250K, which is one of those weird things. Like, you know, businesses get fined hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they'd rather put regular people in for 5 years and then throw that on them.
Right.
Yeah. Just a weird observation. But I mean, I guess another beauty of Ghostbusters is like Sigourney Weaver. Yeah, she was a legitimate actress. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wanted an actress, you'd get Sigourney Weaver.
Absolutely.
Yeah, usually in a supporting role. But, you know, this movie put her on the map, though, which is...
She'd done Aliens before that.
Well, yeah. I mean, would Aliens 2 have... Would Aliens happened if it wasn't for Ghostbusters? Like,
I think it would have. Just because it was the 80s and we need, you know, that niche of the sci-fi action movie was definitely a thing. But yeah, I definitely agree that Ghostbusters absolutely catapulted her career. You know, it made people realize, you know, think of all the comedic roles she's had since then. You definitely wouldn't have had her in Galaxy Quest, Paul, you know, other comedic roles she's had, if she wouldn't have been in Ghostbusters.
Right. Well, I don't think it would have. I mean, I really think it. You look at what she did, Gorillas in the Mist, mm-hmm. Aliens. I mean, she's doing Oscar quality stuff right after Ghostbusters.
Right.
And can you really name a movie between 1979 and 1984 with Sigourney Weaver?
I cannot.
Yeah, that's what I'm like. So. It gets weird. It just gets weird, weird that what this movie did for so many. I mean, Rick Moranis, great character actor, but I don't think anybody would have. I mean, you got Martin Short around there. Why do you need another midget?
Well, you know, Rick Moranis was actually not even supposed to be in the original Ghostbusters. They originally wrote his role for John Candy.
Candy, yeah. And no, Candy, yeah, I know Candy turned it down and told them to put Rick in there.
Yeah, he turned it down after he kind of was working with the writers and Reitman. But, you know, he thought the character should be German. And and wearing lederhosen. And
yeah,
it was completely different from what Rick Moranis brought to the table. And again, I thought he was great in that part. He played a perfect little, you know, typical 80s yuppie nerd.
Yep.
With his vitamin pills and his accountant shit. And it was very...
Always locking himself out of his own apartment.
Yeah. You know, not taking a hint at this woman who's far out of his league.
Oh, yeah. With him. So, in other words, I can blame Rick Moranis for why I was fixated on one girl in junior high through high school.
Dude, we've all been there.
Yeah,
we all have that one girl that like, what were we thinking?
Yeah,
no way that was ever going to happen.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that was the case.
Thanks to 80s movies,
yes,
we all thought we had a shot.
Yeah, Anthony Michael Hall date raping. Yeah,
I was thinking Revenge of the Nerds.
Well, you know, people say Revenge of the Nerds. Oh, it's so disgusting now when you think about it. It's like, no. The word revenge is in the title.
Right.
Like, nobody goes and sees I Spit on Your Grave
thinking it's going to be a wholesome family film.
Yeah. Well, expecting like, oh, she's going to go successfully get her rape kit done. The police are going to do the right thing and immediately process it.
I don't know. I mean, with Revenge of the Nerds, as much as I love that movie, it was on heavy rotation in my house for a while. I could see some of the criticisms, you know, as far as, you know, the date rape aspect and especially, you know, the whole filming without consent, taking pictures and putting them in pie tins. It has its cringe moments to it. It's still a very funny movie.
Well, I'm just saying, if I'm thinking, I'm not a vengeful person. And I'd like to say that I do not practice evil in any way, but I can appreciate the art.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Like, it goes back, you know, it goes all the way back to Porky's with, you know, I can't remember the character's name, but he was asking for it once he stuck his junk into the pipe.
In the shower pipe, yes.
Yeah. I don't, you know, and being somebody who's dealt with professional wrestling and the BS manhood attempts, which some would call sexual assaults.
Sure.
You know, I understand that. No, he didn't, you know, no, you don't ask for it, but.
he definitely didn't expect to have his penis damn near ripped off by a female gorilla gym teacher.
Yes. I think I guess that's the double standard thing is like,
I'm definitely saying
gorilla.
He definitely got his comeuppance, but yeah, at the end of the day, you put your pecker in a pipe hole, you're not expecting a PE teacher to damn near rip it out.
Yeah. No, not some eighth wonder of the world bullshit. Or was she the ninth? No, China was the ninth.
China was the ninth. Yes.
Yes.
Andre was the eighth.
Yeah. So, yeah, in the background, just for stimulation, I got Ghostbusters going on right now. So,
okay.
Yeah, you're going to benefit. We're not going to end up with a two-parter because, like, okay, no, credits are running. Got to wrap around. So right now, we're at She's Not My Girlfriend.
Oh, my God. What's your favorite scene in the original Ghostbusters?
Oh, that's just it. There's just so, like...
There's a lot to choose from.
It's I can just mean. Go off on the... I'm interested in her because she's a client. You know, she sleeps above the covers. 3 feet above the covers. Right.
She barks, she snarls, she drools.
That's a good one. One of my favorites, and I quote this line often, they're in the mayor's office, you know, like, dogs and cats living together.
Mass hysteria.
And to this day, if I, you know, something happens, instead of saying, like, son of a bitch or something like that, I go automatically to mother puss bucket.
Yeah, but there's just so many great lines in that scene, you know. Until Dickless here shut off the grid.
Yes.
Is this true?
It's true, Your Honor. This man has no dick.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, like I said, it's definitely one of those movies where the one-liners are plentiful, the scenes are memorable. Like I said, and everybody was playing their character perfectly.
Yes.
You know, you had the hopeful, eager, scientific guy with Dan Aykroyd. You had the straight man with
Harold Ramis.
Well, I was going to say Ernie. He was kind of your man.
That's the interesting thing about Ernie, because that was supposed to be Eddie Murphy.
Right.
So I like, he's got so some, he might have the best, he might have the best lines, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
Yeah. But yeah, and then he had, of course, the dry wit scientific guy with Harold Ramis.
Yeah.
And you know, his scenes with Annie Potts were hysterical, because she's basically doing everything but throwing her panties at the man.
Yes.
He's just oblivious.
Right.
You know, mold, spores, and fungus.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that was the one thing I wish they would not have done with Ghostbusters 2 is.
Oh, you wish they would have expanded on their possible relationship, as opposed to having her go with Rick Moranis' character.
Right. I mean, okay, one, why are we putting her in a red wig?
I blame that solely on how they drew her in the cartoon.
Oh, okay, yeah, the real Ghostbusters.
Yeah, the cartoon came out before Ghostbusters 2, so that had a lot of influence. Basically, it was like, what can we do in Ghostbusters 2 to tie into the cartoon and sell more toys?
Yes, yeah. I don't know, for me with Ghostbusters, my dad loved it. I mean, it's no Putney Swope. But he watched it and then he brought it down. He was going to show us I don't know what happened. It was like he didn't rewind it far enough back. It's straight up to the marshmallow.
Okay. Battle.
And as a, you know, 4-year-old seeing a flaming face by the end of that, I was totally freaked out.
Oh, I guess, sure.
Yeah. I guess it wasn't till it probably wasn't till the cartoon came out that, like, okay, I gotta actually see what this is.
Well, see, I was exposed to the cartoon first, because that movie came out when I was about 2 years old.
Yeah.
So I saw the cartoon, and that got me to go see Ghostbusters. I actually saw Ghostbusters 2 before Ghostbusters. I was probably 8-9 years old before I actually saw Ghostbusters.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a cartoon that drew me in, obviously, because you know I was the demographic for that cartoon.
Oh,
and of course, you know, the cartoon is going to have all the little kids go see the sequel. Most of those kids probably didn't even see the first one.
Yeah, I don't. It's weird now that I have a nephew and niece and Star Wars, mm-hmm. and everything. Like,
right. They probably can't tell you anything about Return of the Jedi, but they can tell you all about Star Wars Rebels and.
Oh, Clone. Yeah, no, I'm trying to catch up on the Clone Wars now, since I cut Comcast off, and it's like, all right, I guess I just have the Disney Plus, whatever. But it's and then that's also got some weird parental decisions on my behalf. Like I saw, like I will take a day off from work to prep for a Star Wars release.
Okay.
And so I went and saw Rogue One, and like, all right, this is all right. Pretty good. Yeah, Cassian Andor shooting the informant. That's a little intense. But, you know, I've been giving my nephew lightsabers, toys, what have you. And then once Darth Vader goes and just hacks the hell out of
the stuff of nightmares that
yes,
scene.
It's like no, it's
Darth Vader we've been hearing about for 30 years, and yeah. we finally get to see
yeah,
the Dark Lord of the Sith.
Yeah, can't let my nephew see that.
Oh, I see. I'm the complete opposite. I took my nephew, who was 6 or 7 at the time.
Well, my nephew would have been, let's see, what, 4 years old at the time.
Like, okay, that's a little much.
Yeah. Oh no! Now it's like, all right, next time I'm visiting my parents, I'm gonna put Rogue One on. just to see, because he's had Star Wars related nightmares. I mean, we're kids, you know.
Sure.
Any influence? I mean, he didn't have to deal with gremlins. I mean, that's like, I wasn't comfortable with gremlins until me and my ex-girlfriend saw it at the art theater.
Like, oh wow.
Yeah.
No, Gremlins was one I never had a problem with. Like the only thing that kind of the jump scare stuff scared me.
Yeah.
Not so
I'm not a jump scare horror guy. I prefer I want to see what Jigsaw is going to do to this guy.
I mean, I appreciate a good jump scare. Yeah. There are some movies that, you know, horror movies, especially in the late 80s, early 90s, relied too heavily on jump scares.
Yeah.
But, you know, I appreciate a good jump scare.
Right.
Like I said, Gremlins, it has probably about 3 or 4 good ones. But like I said, it's just one of those things, like, you're caught in with, like, dealing with these, you know, demonic Muppets. And then all of a sudden there's a jump scare. So it kind of throws off your perspective.
Yeah. I mean, 84 was just one of the weirdest years in cinema, because you end up getting this PG-13 out of it.
Well, 84 was an interesting year in films, because we had, look at the movies that came out around this time, Ghostbusters, Gremlins, and, you know, it was the
Temple of Doom. Yeah,
it was the start of the special effects boom. You know, Saturday Night Live had been big for, you know, over 10 years at this point, so we were getting into, you know, the comedy aspect. We had raunchy comedies and aspects, you know, when we had, you know, talking about your Porkies and things like that. It was just, like I said, it was just kind of a convergence of all these things that made for very interesting films.
Yes.
Good or bad.
Right. No, I mean, as we established, like, there weren't blockbusters from Ghostbusters all the way till Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
And even that movie, you know, again, it's, again, the convergence of sexual humor, special effects. You know, how do we get, you know, we got to get younger audiences in the theater. So, again, let's bring in every cartoon character that a child's ever loved and put in one movie.
Yeah, no, Mickey Mouse around for twat jokes. That's.
Just saying that kind of puts
everything in perspective.
To be fair, though, Bugs Bunny should have been the one making the twat joke. So I think if any character would have made the twat joke, it would have been Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck.
Yeah, no, but no, it's a Warner Brothers thing. We can agree upon that. But I'm just saying, neither of them. Mickey Mouse.
When you just wouldn't have understood it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the point is Mickey Mouse didn't act. Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, or Daffy. I mean, they left that up to Roger and the Rats.
Right.
Which, it's kind of a shame we haven't gotten a sequel from that, because it's like, you had enough original characters, I think, of true fans.
There was a planned sequel. In fact, if you go online, you can actually see
the script. No.
The script.
I'm aware of that, but it's like...
Yeah, if you go on, I believe, Low Carb Comedy's website, they actually do a script reading of Roger Rabbit 2, Toon Patrol or something like that. And yeah. The funny thing is, it's actually a prequel. It takes place in World War II, which was before Who Framed Roger.
Okay. Yeah, no, I've seen, yeah, we all saw what Walton Warner Brothers was doing with World War II. That's probably not a good idea. So, but
we've been all over the place.
Yeah, no, stuff. No. And, well, we've basically, as I said, I just need to get the content. So I'm willing to work with the guests however I can. I've got this guy who hasn't responded yet. Like, I've called him out on the podcast. I've gone and texted him like, come on, man, you want to do Batman? Because you thought this was called 90s for chill. Like, no, I'm not going to do that. No, look, you can just talk about you. If you go from, do you take Danny Elfman? You go to Pee-wee's Big Adventure. You go to Beetlejuice, which would be a great combination if we could somehow work Beetlejuice versus the Ghostbusters.
Oh, wow.
It's Sony. It's Warner Brothers. Yeah, it wouldn't work.
No.
You can't make it happen. I don't know. Sony doesn't really have a streaming service, really. Crackle don't count.
No, like I said, yeah, it's weird because they're kind of like the last ones to the dance on this, you know. Well,
nobody takes Lionsgate seriously, but.
Well, no, I don't even think people at Lionsgate take Lionsgate seriously.
They're a great distributor. I think they have most of the A24 stuff, so.
First Punisher movie. Not the one with
Warzone. Warzone with Ray Stevenson. That's I mean they have their horror movies, but it's yeah. When you think Lionsgate and you think horror movies, you understand why they're not getting in the streaming game.
I want to go back and correct myself. Hasselhoff was in the Nick Fury movie. Dolph Lundgren
Dolph Lundgren.
I want to correct my 80s icon Marvel.
Well, you see, I'm a huge, I have not watched either of them, and I'm a huge Louis Gossett Jr. apologist, so it's kind of like.
I don't think there's much he has to really apologize for a lot of his movies. I mean, they're good movies.
Iron Eagle 3 and 4.
They're good movies if you're hammered?
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah, yeah. Good in Boardwalk Empire for his one season. I guess since we're on this and I'm just pulling something from the rewatchables, they've just gotten up to the roof.
Okay.
Could Ghostbusters be remade in a 10 episode Netflix series?
An argument could be made for maybe 8. I don't know if you could stretch it to 10.
Okay, well, but the point of the matter is, it's like, I don't know. I'm a big cinema guy, but it's almost to the point where it's like, television, I mean, as long as you're spending movie dollars on television, it works out.
Well, movie dollars and television doesn't always, you know, equate to good television, because, you know, I could always bring up the final season of Game of Thrones. A butt ton. Well,
you blame that one on the producers not wanting to actually, just wanting to close the book so they could do their What If the Confederacy Won series, which immediately got canceled the moment they said, yeah, that's what we're doing next.
I mean, you know, even, I don't know if you were a fan of the TV series Sons of Anarchy, but as soon as that show is over, they basically gave the showrunner carte blanche to do whatever he wanted, and he did a medieval show called The Bastard Executioner, and it barely limped through its first season.
Oh, you know, like, yeah, no, it's like...
And success doesn't go hand in hand.
Yeah, but Sons of Anarchy didn't have the movie budget, necessarily.
No, it had the movie talent. Like, it definitely had talent behind the screen and in front of the screen. But yeah, as far as the budget, yeah, it definitely was a little shoestring. Because they spent it all on fake tattoos and CGI in Ron Perlman's face onto a stunt rider since he was terrified of motorcycles.
I guess what that goes down to is, like, I bring up Westworld, I guess. And that's what I would think you'd want kind of have a vibe with Ghostbusters. In a sense.
Okay. I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, Westworld definitely is a movie budget on a...
I mean, could you, but the question then becomes kind of like the Jeff Goldblum thing from Jurassic Park, just because you could doesn't mean you should. Could you make it the Ghostbusters series? Absolutely. Should you? Probably not.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much after doing a binge for my Jeff Goldblum episode of the podcast, because he's such a talent. You need to give him that extra 30 minutes.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he really, you have the Fly. That's
Fly,
that. I mean, Brie, when it comes to brevity.
Sure.
You have the Fly. I have not seen Earth Girls Are Easy, but that's still an hour 41.
I love how dumb that movie is.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies, you turn your brain off, you look at Gina Davis in a bikini in the early 80s.
Oh, well, late 80s, but...
No, yeah, early late... Yeah, I guess it was more late 80s. You know, Damon Wayans and Jim Carrey are your supporting cast. Let that sink in for a minute. Two of the biggest comedy names of the 90s were your background comedy characters.
Right. Well, I guess when it comes to Jeff Goldblum, it's still like... I mean, he was gold in Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah.
And that's slightly long. It's almost the point with this podcast to make it work. It's like, you know, if I probably watch the, you know, time the credits on Ghostbusters, since it was so much special effects and such,
mm-hmm.
The credits may have pushed it beyond the...
Oh, yeah. The credits tack on close to 10 minutes.
Well... I mean, in the 80s, I think it was closer to 5-6 minutes. Because I think my older sister was saying, like, Little Mermaid had the longest credits for a while.
Yeah, well, anime movies generally do have longer credits.
Yeah, but... Yeah, it's Miller time. All right, that's where we're at.
Okay. I don't know. I never pictured that. I never pictured that ensemble drinking Miller. I always seen like Murray would be drinking like some sort of cheap scotch. Harold Ramis would be doing like, I'm sure craft brew was still still probably a thing in the early 80s. He would be drinking a craft brew
in New York. Yeah.
Oh yeah. You know, Aykroyd would try to act like a big guy and drink tequila shots, but only get about two of them in. And, Ernie would sit back and just watch the white guys get wasted.
Yes, yes. I was about to say, don't say a cult, man.
No, I wasn't going to go with the stereotypical slam dunk of a cult 45. We're not talking about Billy Dee Williams.
Yeah, well, but it's like, if Billy Dee Williams is on the scene, though, I think we're all drinking cults. And I don't drink beer. Have you seen anything from Afterlife? Because I saw this thing on Twitter where Ivan Reitman, and now Jason Reitman, is a brilliant director.
Yeah, Jason. Well, he did Juno. That was kind of his start.
Well, I mean, actually, Thank You for Smoking was before Juno.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that one.
Yeah. And he knows how to capture Diablo Cody. Diablo Cody probably would be, I think she's probably got the talent, but she's definitely.
Right.
Yeah. No, she's not a director at this point. And I think critics will agree.
A little bit of the trailers and stuff I've seen for Afterlife. I definitely like, it definitely has the spirit of the original, which gives me hope. I like kind of the fact that almost everyone kind of has forgotten that they existed, you know,
yeah.
Being almost 40 years after the fact.
Right. Well, the one thing I've seen was like Ivan Reitman showing a clip to Bill Murray of like Paul Rudd.
Yes, Paul Rudd and the Mini Marshmallow Man.
Yes, and like, no, that was like the Mini Marshmallow Man. That's my kind of humor. That is like,
oh, sure, absolutely.
This is Joe Dante stuff, you know.
Right.
Like roasting each other, making like.
Yeah, like. And being happy about it. That was the part that got me.
Yes.
They're roasting the little bastard and he's laughing about it. I'm like, yes, this is what I need right now.
It's what Kevin Smith was trying to do with Yoga Hosers.
Oh, yes, the Bratzies. I'm a huge Kevin Smith fan, almost apologetically so. And I enjoyed most of Yoga Hosers.
Yeah.
Like, I wish they would have focused more on like the Clerks aspect of it, of focusing more on the girls in the convenience store,
yeah,
as opposed to the weird satanic Nazi part of it.
But how do you put Johnny Depp in a convenience store? That just seems way too ordinary. Like, you got the best out of him in the convenience store when he did the Tusk.
Yes,
Like,
and I think if they hadn't done that scene in Tusk, they probably could have made it work in Yoga Hosers. But yeah. You're right. They'd already kind of gone to the well with that in Tusk when they were trying to find the title character.
Yeah, Justin Long, right?
Thank you. I was drawing a blank on
that. Yeah, like, oh, they did that in the Big Lebowski. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's where I got it from. But thank God for Tarantino throwing in the Depp kid and Harley Quinn into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I will go ahead and out myself right now. I'm one of the six people on the planet that has not seen that yet.
Oh, I've only seen it once, and I regret like every time I bring it up because it's that like, oh, I really do need to watch it again.
Well, it's long as shit, isn't it?
Oh, it's probably a good 240, 250, yeah.
I thought it was closing on the 3-hour mark.
It doesn't feel like it. I'll say that.
The problem I have with a lot of Tarantino movies is I enjoy the dialogue, but at the same time, like Inglourious Bastards is always the example I bring up.
I rip off a lot of stuff from Tarantino when I wrote my zombie screenplay. So yeah.
There's only like five scenes. If you really think about it, there's only like five scenes in Inglourious Bastards.
Well,
they just all go on for 25 minutes,
and it's
like a block full of dialogue.
Well, you could say the same thing about Reservoir Dogs. You have the table scene, and then it's just a series of flashbacks.
That movie's edited with the flashbacks and, you know, the action sequences and whatnot. That one I think has a better flow to it.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I definitely can see that. Like you got to be in. Like Tarantino doesn't give you a choice. You have to be all in on whatever he does.
I'm not bashing Tarantino movies. I actually love Hateful Eight, and that one again, like Inglourious Basterds, that only really has about five or six scenes in it.
Yeah. No, he's a guy who's in love with his dialogue more than anything. Which is a pity, because I think Bastards, he finally showed that he wasn't really a great director, I would even say, with Reservoir Dogs, Jackie Brown, or Pulp Fiction.
Well, those also happen to be his first three movies as well.
Right, but I'm just saying it's like, he's probably the best writer in Hollywood.
Yeah, I can argue with that. I can go with that.
Yeah, so I mean... So it's like, for me, Inglourious Basterds and Kill Bill 1 and 2, like, oh, he's finally showing that he's got some direction. And I think that all kind of culminates with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay.
I always
bring up the Robert Rodriguez tangent on that. Like, it seems like for every Robert Rodriguez movie Tarantino's in, his next movie shows a little bit more direction. Like, you know, he Rodriguez rubs off on Tarantino, and Tarantino movies get better.
Yeah, no, I can even say that. Like, I'm a Death Proof apologist. Like,
I love Death Proof.
Yeah,
Death Proof.
Like, I mean, you the problem with Death Proof really is that it was in the grindhouse, and it's like, no, you need to see the full version of Death Proof.
Right. I've seen both versions. I like both versions, but yes, definitely the fuller version is a little bit better.
Right. Right. And, which, you know, basically, you know, after the 10th movie, all we're really going to have right now in Hollywood, I guess, would be, at least from a North American standpoint, would be Reitman and Fincher.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
you got PTA, but you don't know when he's going to do something.
I would say, yeah, you know, people say you can set a watch to things with Paul Thomas Anderson movies. You can set a grandfather clock to them.
Yes, you can. There's no question. Except with Punch Drunk Love. That one is like, we did 2 weeks of Sandler podcast recently. So it's like, Punch Drunk Love is the one exception. I mean, I guess I would suggest if you want to get introduced to P.T. Anderson and you're not somebody who's totally into quirkiness, Punch Drunk Love is the way to do it. It's like, as Joe Goldwitzer said, it's like that should have been a he felt it was, and I have not seen Magnolia. I own it. But
I have not seen that one as well.
That's coming just, up it, with 3.5 hours to watch it is just
right.
The entire point of 90 for Chill is like you don't have the time to get yourself in a binge on TV. You need something more than one episode. Right. So, yeah, I mean, you're really going to have like 3 directors, Paul Thomas Anderson. Well, I guess you could say Christopher Nolan, depending on which side of the Atlantic wants to claim him. Cause It gets really weird when you see his brother, Jonathan Nolan. It's like, that guy is a Yankee.
Well, you talk about which side wants, you know, it's a lot like Guy Ritchie movies, you know, some movies he makes for the American audience and other movies are so British they need subtitles.
Yes. Oh no, and those are the ones I prefer personally, but all right, so Murray's Got the Girl, directed by Ivan Reitman, is up there. So I think
that's got the good Ghostbusters song going on and everybody's happy now.
Yeah, you know, that was my biggest thing coming into this. It's like, how can I get this into the 90 for Chill time frame under 100 minutes? Like, do I cut the Ghostbusters montage?
See, those are always kind of, I always enjoyed like the montage like that at the end of a movie that just shows the characters.
Well, it's not the character bit. It's like after they capture Slimer.
Oh, that, yes.
Yeah. You need the montage. There's no question there.
Yeah, after the montage, you can cut it, right.
Well, no, but I'm just saying you kind of need the montage because you got to show that these guys got established.
Oh, yeah.
So it's that's the only thing I think you can cut from this. It's like, and it's almost like I want them to, like I've seen this scene of the two homeless guys arguing Bruce Lee versus.
You know, and talk, you'll get a good power forward for the Knicks.
Yeah. So. But no, I mean, it's just more and more you think back to Ghostbusters, the more and more timeless you think it is. I mean, you realize it is.
A lot of the scenes that were cut from the movie, you know, going back to that, you know, were small things, like small little things, like, you know, Rick Moranis going up to Sigourney Weaver going, "Did we?" And she's like, "No, Lewis, no."
Yes,
totally did not bone on top of the skyscraper.
No. I do remember that being filmed and cut. It's kind of the stuff that you know that was filmed and you know that was written, and the problem with the time, you know, like, oh yeah, we're running out of money since we had to invent everything.
Yeah, we had to get a giant marshmallow suit.
Yeah, like, I mean, the entire going back to the ghost blowjob.
Yes,
it's like there was supposed to be an entire set piece.
It was supposed to be a much larger portion of the film than the 10 seconds we got.
Yeah, so I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's just you rarely get something as brilliant as Ghostbusters, something so perfect.
Well, I mean, it's a movie that still holds up. I was watching it on TV literally 2 days ago. It was on, I can't even remember what channel it was on, but it was on, and that's one of those movies I'll even watch with the commercials. Like, yeah. I love that movie that much. Like, if it's on TV, I'm watching it. I got the DVD.
Well, I'm more of the type who, like, when my girlfriend caught me watching Goodfellas, like, on BBC America, it's like, you know what? Screw this. I have this on digital. Let's switch the input and go from there. But if it wasn't on TV, I wouldn't go and be like the snooty cinema snob.
Like, sure.
Yeah. I mean,
well, and the fact that, you know, almost 40 years after that movie came out, we're still excited about the third installment of that trilogy timeline, you know, not counting the all female version. You know, like I said, 40 years and it's still holding up. We're still excited for more. It's still, I would say it's just as popular as it now as it was then.
Right. But I think what it comes down to is you have to realize, though, if it wasn't for Meatballs, and
right,
if it wasn't for Caddyshack and Animal House.
Yeah, if it wasn't for all those Saturday Night Live movies from back, you know, back in that time frame, if it wasn't for that, you know, that cast, those act, you know, those comedians, yeah, we wouldn't have that.
And it's kind of nuts that we have. I mean, I guess you could say with some Will Ferrell movies, we kind of gotten that, like Ricky Bobby.
I'll give you Old School.
No, Anchorman.
Yeah. You hit a weird. This is going to get me in so much trouble with some of my comedy friends. I'm not a huge Will Ferrell fan. I love him on Saturday Night Live. His movies, not so much.
No. I totally understand the disconnect there. He's definitely a writer more than he is.
I loved him on Saturday Night Live, and even when he would come back and do guest spots or host, when he would have these films, I enjoyed his work on Saturday Night Live more than I did Talladega Nights, the Anchorman movies.
He's a character actor.
Oh yeah.
And no, there's no way he should have had all these leading, these projects. Oh, yeah. I definitely understand the disconnect there. But even then, with him, it's like he's the only Saturday Night Live guy really doing anything from that period.
Yeah, for the most part, a lot of guys from that early mid '90s troupe tried, and didn't do too well. I'm looking at you, Chris Kattan.
Yeah. I'm just saying it kind of shows how. Like, we're not going to get a goat. The closest thing you had to Ghostbusters was Ghostbusters Answer the Call, it's like Steve Martin. I didn't think it took me a moment to realize, oh, he was never a cast member.
No.
He's just so synonymous with the show still.
Right.
And I guess you could say Melissa McCarthy had that.
Yeah, but Melissa McCarthy had that. She was cast adjacent.
Yeah,
kind of like with Harold Ramis, he was never really part of Saturday Night Live, but kind of adjacent.
No, he was definitely like, oh, there's that Second City show.
I mean, obviously the argument is being made, if it wasn't for Second City, whether it be the one north of the border in Canada or the one in Chicago, we wouldn't have Saturday Night.
Oh, no. That's the ultimate irony. The most New York thing is a product of
Chicago and Toronto.
Toronto. Well, and you can say L.A. with the Groundlings, but.
Sure. I mean, Groundlings has, they've had lots of Saturday Night Live as well.
But, it's just what really weird looking back on it. And this kind of brings us to the base that I'm selling this podcast on. The Reitman, Ramis, Murray, we're getting to Ghostbusters. I think if you're a smart guy, like, you're not going to talk about Ghostbusters regardless of your rules.
Sure. I mean, going back to, like you said, with Meatballs and Caddyshack, Animal House, from there, all roads lead to Ghostbusters. Like, it was going to happen. It had to happen.
Right. And it's just weird that we haven't, I'm just saying, it's just really, when you stop and look at it, it's weird we haven't had something like that happen since.
Well, I mean, you go on a whole tangent of, as far as what is funny now as opposed to what was funny 40 years ago, what you can get away with then that you maybe can't now.
Well, I'm one of the types who just basically I think Mel Brooks has been paranoid about his kind of comedy working. It's like, no, if you nail it, you just have to nail it.
If somebody walked into a movie office today with the script of Blazing Saddles, there's no way that movie gets made.
There's no way a major studio is going to make it.
Sure.
But I'm just saying, and it hardly got made to begin with. Anyhow, sure. Richard Pryor got cut out of that movie.
Well, it's funny, like. People realize that Richard Pryor was a writer on that movie, and you would think a lot of the stereotypical African American stuff is what he wrote. He wrote most of Mongo's scene, like Mongo just pawning Game of Life. That was Richard Pryor.
Yes. No, I mean, he was, but I'm just saying, like, the sheer fact that Richard Pryor was attached to a movie about racism. No, I'm just saying, you have to, like, if you nail the comedy,
oh, sure,
it can be done. Which I think is just like, okay, so comedy is a greater challenge now than it was.
Okay, I'll give you that. 40
years ago. So, yeah, no, I and fully acknowledge bleeding heart liberal, but man, like, I think it was we were doing Cards Against Humanity at the bank.
Okay.
And then whatever it was, if you could choose to end something, and then one of the cards was racism, and it's like, and it was my choice on which card won, and it's like, this. What do you mean it's not racism? I can't help but laugh a little bit.
I mean, racist humor when done right is very funny.
As I said, you just have to nail it. You can't miss.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, when you miss, we get things like Pootie Tang.
Yeah. Right.
Soul Plane, stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah. So that's where I get off on comedy. But so yeah, I'm just looking at the guy staring out of the Ecto One right now. Somehow there's no way a reflection of those three people in the driver's side window can work. So, but thank you very much, Andrew TD, for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, man.
Yep. Where can they find you on social media? Do you have anything to promote?
I have nothing to promote on social media. You can find me on Facebook and Andrew TD. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at ClassWatch. And I have 25,000 followers on TikTok at The Couchman. So,
oh, please, right. Well,
yeah, I don't do much with my day except make TikTok videos. So I'm essentially a teenage girl.
Dang, I didn't realize it was actually, like, you know, it. I thought it was a younger man's game, but.
I am 39 years old here in a couple weeks, and yes, I spend way too many hours a day on TikTok. But I'm more than I care to admit.
No, that's, if anything, that's my regret for being more of a wanting to be more of a writer than a performer. Because I don't I don't know. I can perform, like, if you give me something, like, I've been in stupid dance-offs and wrestling rings. Like, we're going to do the kid and play.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, okay. Like, I've never actually seen any of those movies, man. And it's like, okay, no, we can hit it. And I'll nail it. And then I'll kick the promoter in the head.
I'm of the thought that all comedians are narcissistic attention whores, and that's why we do what we do. We just want people to look at us.
And that, I can definitely tell you that I am amongst you, at least in terms of the diagnoses.
Wrestlers and comedians, you know, the parallels between the two are so close, it's not even funny.
Oh no, it's really just the difference of punchlines.
Literally and figuratively.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for coming on. Great talking to you. If you got another idea, let me know about it. Love to have you back.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
All right.
Long live Flash. You've saved your life. Have a nice day.